does beauty have to do with sports, or advanced technology, or the economy? I am Isabella Rossellini, and in each episode of This Is Not a Beauty Podcast, I uncover stories that explain beauty's fascinating and often hidden role in modern life. Listen to This Is Not a Beauty Podcast now on your favorite podcast platform. Brought to you by L'Oréal Group.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, as a candidate, Donald Trump called Beau Bergdahl a dirty, rotten traitor for walking off his base in Afghanistan and suggested as punishment sending him back and dumping him out of an airplane. On Monday, with Trump now his commander-in-chief, Bergdahl went before a military court that will determine his punishment. It's Tuesday, October 17th. Matt Rosenberg, tell me about what happened on May 31st, 2014.
President Obama walks out into the Rose Garden.
Good afternoon, everybody.
And announces that the only POW American soldier held by the Taliban has been freed.
This morning, I called Bob and Jannie Bergdahl and told them that after nearly 5 years in captivity, their son, Beau, is coming home.
The soldier is Beau Bergdahl. He was freed in a prisoner swap. They sent five senior Taliban leaders in exchange for him. And
as part of this effort, the United States is transferring five detainees from the prison in Guantanamo Bay to Qatar. The Qatari government has given us assurances that it will put in place measures to protect our national security.
At this ceremony is Bergdahl's parents, his father, Bob, and his mother, Jannie.
Sergeant Bergdahl has missed birthdays and holidays and the simple moments with family and friends, which all of us take for granted. But while Beau was gone, he was never forgotten.
And it's this incredibly dramatic moment. I mean, there had been years of negotiations for his release. He had been the focus of manhunts. He was the sole American soldier held by the Taliban. And as you know, the military really does mean it when it says they no man left behind. That is part of how they operate.
He wasn't forgotten by his community in Idaho or the military, which rallied to support the Bergdahls through thick and thin. And he wasn't forgotten by his country, because the United States of America does not ever leave our men and women in uniform behind.
And Matt, what did President Obama say about the controversial circumstances surrounding the situation that day in the Rose Garden?
He didn't really address it. He kept the mood focused on the fact that Sergeant Bergdahl was coming home.
Bob and Jannie, today families across America share in the joy that I know you feel. As a parent, I can't imagine the hardship that you guys have gone through. As president, I know that I speak for all Americans when I say we cannot wait for the moment when you are reunited and your son, Beau, is back in your arms.
This was something for Americans to celebrate and to be happy about and to be relieved about. And that was really the focus of his comments. And I think, you know, if you were watching this at home and didn't know any of the context, you wouldn't necessarily know there was controversy here.
Wonderful. A good day.
Yes, that's a good day.
Of course, this scene in the Rose Garden proved to be a hugely significant and controversial moment. What was so controversial about the rescue and release of this American soldier?
You know, Bergdahl was captured by the Taliban because he walked off his base. And his story has been that he believed there were command problems at his base, and that his plan, this is a story he's told, that he planned to walk to a bigger base about 18 miles away and report his command problems. Now, the military investigators who interviewed him said that, you know, he was incredibly naive. He had completely unrealistic expectations for his deployment and what he would be doing. And during the nearly 5 years he was held, there were moments when anonymous sources often raised questions about whether he deserted, whether he had willingly joined the Taliban, had he converted to Islam. There were a lot of people in the military who saw a deserter here and not a prisoner of war. And in the days kind of following his release, this quickly became a political football, you know.
I've got a lot of questions. You know, first and foremost, I spent all week listening to the administration say, you know, we're a country that never leaves their people behind. We'll never leave you behind. That's all well and good, except...
You had Republican strategists. I remember this. We wrote in one of our stories, organizing interviews with veterans who were supposedly involved in the manhunt for Bergdahl, and saying, you know, people have been injured, people have been wounded, and that's still part of the case here and still very much in dispute.
You know, when I went through survival training, we talked about the issue of being left behind. It was pretty much an understanding that as long as you don't leave your country behind, your country will never leave you behind. So,
and this is how much of a political issue this case has become.
And back now to the firestorm over the president's deal to give up five top terror suspects for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl.
Soldiers on the ground at the time tell CNN that insurgents were able to take advantage of the massive military undertaking to try to rescue Bergdahl, with IEDs placed more effectively and ambushes more calculated.
His decision to walk off the base and his ensuing capture by the Taliban had, the storyline quickly became, had diverted resources and put Americans at risk, including some who were injured quite grievously.
Here we are, wasting so much more extra energy and time and blood, sweat, and tears for someone who purposefully walked away and didn't want to be found. He didn't want to be found. And so we were chasing a ghost around eastern Afghanistan for at least 90 days immediately following his disappearance.
That he had hurt the American cause.
He had hurt the American cause. And, you know, and this began spreading really quickly to the point where, so Bergdahl's from a place called Haley, Idaho, which is the town right next to where Sun Valley is, a kind of famous ski resort. And the town had planned on holding a big parade and a celebration for Bergdahl. They had to cancel it because a biker gang threatened to disrupt it.
Wow.
They were getting bomb threats. They were getting death threats to the town hall. They had to kind of shut down all the celebrations. And, you know, I went back to that town in January 16, and there were still people there who were occasionally get threats.
But take Sergeant Bergdahl. Does anybody remember that name? So.
By the time the 2016 presidential campaign rolls around, Donald Trump is campaigning on Bergdahl. What is Trump saying about him?
I mean, he's calling Bergdahl
a dirty, rotten traitor.
He's saying beautiful people were killed trying to find him. I mean, I think one of his quotes was, I don't want him.
I don't want him. Maybe we can send him back. Let's fly him over. We'll dump him right in the middle. Throw him out of the plane. Should we give him a parachute or not? I say no. No, don't give him a parachute. I don't want him. Why would we want to waste a parachute? See?
And is Trump voicing the sentiment of many members of the military? And I ask you that, Matt, in particular, because you have covered the U.S. Armed Forces for so long. Is this how soldiers and veterans felt at all?
I mean, it's a tough one, because I think there is a certain population of, the people in the military who did feel that way. There are a lot of others who would say, you know, we found what he did despicable and terrible, but he is one of ours and we need to get him back. And I think that was the general sentiment, that nobody had sympathy for him, and they thought he had put people at risk. He had diverted a ton of their time and their energy and when they were trying to fight a war. But that, yes, he's American and they need to get him back. Leaving him in the hands of the Taliban was not something that the U.S. military does.
What I know today is what the President of the United States knows, that it would have been offensive and incomprehensible to consciously leave an American behind, no matter what, to leave an American behind in the hands of people who would torture him, cut off his head, do any number of things, and we would consciously choose to do that. That's the other side of this equation. I don't think anybody would think that is the appropriate thing to do. And
you spoke with Bergdahl's lawyers back in 2016. How were they thinking about his situation at the time?
Lawyers were looking at President Trump's comments, I know they were, and keeping a running tally and saying, you know, if Trump gets elected, we're going to argue that there can't be a fair trial, that every person involved in a military trial reports to the president, ultimately, and that this is terribly prejudiced. I think they were also promoting the same sentiment that was shared by some of the military, including the American general who kind of debriefed him and kind of got the full story out of Bergdahl, said that prison was simply not an appropriate place for Bergdahl to end up.
Why not?
That he had suffered immensely under the Taliban, that he had been tortured, and that, you know, this was not a young man who deserved to be put in prison at this point in his life, that he had suffered far more than any American prison could do to him, and that there were other ways to handle this.
Many of us heard Bergdahl describe his time in captivity in his own words in the second season of Serial,
yeah.
which was all about this story. Yeah. Remind us what that experience was like for him.
I mean, it was horrific. He was kept in a cage for years. You know, his conditions got progressively worse. There were beatings, and he was treated like an animal. And the general who debriefed Bergdahl said the abuse was so profound that it was the worst abuse sustained by any American soldier since the Vietnam War. He suffered immensely.
They kind of had you in a really dark room, almost sounded like a basement, like where there was no light.
There's a few rooms like that.
Yeah.
It's like, how do I explain to a person that just standing in an empty, dark room hurts? It's like, well, you know, someone asks you, well, why does it hurt? Does your body hurt? Yes, your body hurts, but it's more than that. It's like this mental, like, you're almost confused. You know, there's times when I'd wake up and it's just so dark. Like, I would wake up not even remembering, like, what I was. You know how you get that feeling when that word is on the tip of your tongue?
Yeah.
That happened to me, only it was like, what am I? Like, I couldn't see my hands. I couldn't do anything. The only thing I could do was, like, touch my face. And it, even that wasn't, like, you know, registering, right?
Yeah.
You know, to the point where you just want to scream. And you can't, like, I can't scream. I can't risk that. So it's like you're standing there screaming in your mind in this room. You're standing, like, in this blackened dirt room that's tiny. And just on the other side of that flimsy little door, wooden door that you could probably easily rip off the hinges is the entire world out there. It is everything that you're missing. It is everybody, everyone is out there. You know, that breath that you're trying to breathe, that release that you're trying to get, everything is beyond that door. And, I mean, I hate doors now.
Rich Oppel is covering Bergdahl's trial at Fort Bragg in North Carolina.
Just about a few minutes before 9 o'clock, he walked into a tiny courthouse on base here at Fort Bragg. He looked grim-faced as he walked in, and while he spoke, you know, you could see wrinkles in his forehead. He looked like he was under a lot of pressure and was very serious. So Sergeant Bergdahl was wearing, like all of his military lawyers, his formal dress blue Army uniform. For most of the proceeding today, he sat at the table with his lawyers, but at a few points, he stood and faced the judge, Jeffrey Nance, a colonel. He did look healthier than he's looked before, but he looked like he was under a lot of stress, and he was definitely taking the moment seriously.
Rich, what are the charges that Bo Bergdahl faces in court?
So there are two charges. One is desertion, which carries a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment. And in the much more serious charge is something called misbehavior before the enemy, which is an old charge and one that's rarely used. And in this case, it means he endangered the troops who were sent to search for him after he disappeared.
So that's interesting. Desertion is one thing. This misbehavior is another, although it seems like one could necessarily lead to the other. But they're different charges, and the misbehavior is much more serious.
That's right. But you raise a good point, and one that his chief defense counsel, Eugene Fidel, has made, which is, in his view, the misbehavior before the enemy charge was just a way to essentially charge him twice for the same alleged misconduct.
And so what did Bergdahl do in court on Monday?
So the judge began by asking Sergeant Bergdahl if he understood the charges against him and the specific language of each charge. And Sergeant Bergdahl replied that he did. Then the judge asked him to talk about what happened after he left the base. And Sergeant Bergdahl, among other things, said that he, after 20 minutes, had gotten lost. The judge asked him to talk about how many times he had tried to escape and to describe some of that. And Sergeant Bergdahl said he had tried to escape 12 to 15 times, he estimated. And he talked about one time, the first day he was captured, where he tried to make a run for it, even though he was chained at the wrist behind his back and blindfolded, but he was tackled by villagers. And another time where he was on the run for 8 days, and he frantically tried to wave at drones, American drones above him, to try to get the drone operators to recognize who he was and to send help. But that never happened.
Rich, why do you think that the judge was asking the questions he was asking? What might he have been trying to get at by asking Bergdahl how many times he tried to escape from the Taliban?
Well, I think he was really trying to understand Bergdahl's motivation and intent and his frame of mind. And definitely he was trying to get a sense of whether Bergdahl was doing what he's supposed to be doing as a captive American soldier. And that's been the testimony consistently on this for several years. The Army's own investigator, General Dahl, that talked to Bergdahl when he got back, was really clear in the preliminary hearing 2 years ago that Bergdahl did what he was supposed to do to try to resist and try to get away when he could from his captors.
Right. One of the initial questions was, is this someone who somehow aligned himself with the Taliban? The fact that he tried to escape many times would suggest not.
Yeah, that's one thing that's been pretty well disproven. And in fact, General Dahl believed the story that Bergdahl told him in their interview in 2014 that, you know, that was not what was at issue. I mean, he was trying to get to this other base to complain about problems that he perceived within his own unit. And it was nothing about trying to desert or join the Taliban or anything like that. General Dahl was pretty emphatic about that during that testimony.
Did he express any regret for what he did and what kind of mobilization it caused within the military, which remains such a controversial element of all this?
He did. He said at one point he described it as inexcusable, and he understood that he had broken the law. As the morning wore on, the hearing reached a climax, and he pled guilty to the two charges. And then the gravity of the moment really sank in, I'm sure, not just on Sergeant Bergdahl, but on everybody in the courtroom. The judge asked him if he understood that among the penalties he would now face with his guilty pleas were life in prison, and the sergeant said, yes, sir. And then the judge asked both the prosecution and the defense, is there any agreement as part of these guilty pleas to limit his punishment? And both sides said no. And then so he then turned again to Sergeant Bergdahl and said, well, knowing this, are you sure you want to plead guilty? And he said, yes.
So the judge is just making sure that Bergdahl understands that by pleading guilty to these two charges that you've described, that he may spend the rest of his life in prison, and then the defense and the prosecutor, that they all agree that the punishment could be that severe.
That's right. That's right.
Rich, what happened to the defense's argument that Trump's statements made it impossible for Bergdahl to have a fair trial? Why didn't that come up in court on Monday?
Well, the judge ruled in February that while President Trump's comments were, quote, disturbing, he didn't see a reason to dismiss the charges, and he did not think that those comments had prejudiced the case.
And what else has Bergdahl's defense team been arguing that will still be a factor in the case as it heads into sentencing?
Well, it's been a number of things. One thing was that Sergeant Bergdahl's diagnosed mental health issues should be taken into account, and they had laid a lot of the blame for what happened on the Army itself, questioning whether Sergeant Bergdahl ever should have been enlisted in the first place. The defense team had also argued that in addition to there not being any evidence of soldiers being killed during the search, that a handful of service members who were wounded badly during the search, that their wounds could not be directly linked to Sergeant Bergdahl, because in one case, on one operation, a military investigation later found that the operation had been very poorly planned. And in another case, the operation appeared to be a dual-purpose mission, according to the defense team, that it was not just to get Sergeant Bergdahl, but it was also to target a well-known Taliban insurgent.
So finally, Rich, what happens next to Bergdahl?
A sentencing hearing is scheduled to begin next Monday, where prosecutors will put on evidence for why there should be a stiff punishment for Sergeant Bergdahl. At the same time, the defense will make a couple of counterarguments. They are expected to argue that the extraordinary torture that Sergeant Bergdahl suffered during his years in captivity reflect a profound consequences for what he has done already. So in a lot of ways, the case really is about sort of two conflicting thoughts. One is that, you know, you never leave your unit, you never leave your fellow soldiers. But on the other hand, the military, as President Obama pointed out that very first day in the Rose Garden, right after Sergeant Bergdahl had been returned to the U.S., you know, the military never leaves soldiers behind.
Right.
And so those two things did seem to be in conflict here. And depending on how the hearing goes next week, it could be very fateful for Sergeant Bergdahl.
On Monday afternoon, during a news conference at the White House, President Trump was asked directly if his comments as a candidate might have affected Bergdahl's ability to receive a fair trial.
And can you respond to his attorney's
claim? Well, I can't comment on Bergdahl because he's, as you know, there. I guess he's doing something today, as we know, and he's also they're setting up sentencing. So I'm not going to comment on him, but I think people have heard my comments in the past.
We'll be right back.
How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for the New York Times, covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's what else you need to know today.
Thank you very much. I just want to say that we just spent quite a bit of time inside with the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, who has been a friend of mine for a long time, long before my world of politics. Early into his world of politics, I think.
After months of bitter disagreements and name-calling, President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell walked into the Rose Garden on Monday, began an impromptu news conference, and declared themselves close allies.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. President. I want to underscore what the President said. We have the same agenda. We've been friends and acquaintances for a long time. We talk frequently. We don't give you a readout every time we have a conversation, but frequently we talk on the weekends about the issues that are before us.
Trump has repeatedly mocked McConnell for failing to pass legislation, while McConnell has repeatedly criticized Trump for failing to understand the legislative process.
We are probably now, despite what we read, we're probably now, I think, at least as far as I'm concerned, closer than ever before.
And earlier this year, an observatory in Washington state detected an unusual signal coming from a small constellation of stars in outer space. Soon after, a global team of astronomers spotted a new pinprick of light in the night sky. It faded from blue to red and then vanished. On Monday, scientists revealed what they had heard and seen.
Today, we're thrilled to announce that scientists have detected gravitational waves coming from the collision of two neutron stars, the smallest and densest stars. This event occurred 130 million light years from Earth in a galaxy far away.
For the first time, astronomers had observed the collision of such stars, which is believed to have played a key role in the formation of the universe and is responsible for creating almost all of the world's precious metals, including uranium, silver, and gold. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. Thanks to the team at Serial and filmmaker Mark Boll for the audio of Bo Bergdahl. See you tomorrow.